All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Mike Mancine, and I'm going to talk to you today about the screening program that we have at L.A. County USC Emergency Department. And I titled the talk Opportunities, Barriers, and Lessons Learned for no particularly good reason. I'd like to acknowledge a couple of my partners in crime, I guess, Dr. Sanjay Arora, who's also an emergency physician, and Dr. Kathleen Jacobson, who's a family medicine practitioner and HIV specialist. All right. So the disclosure is, as Monique already said, all three of us receive salary support from Gilead Sciences through the FOCUS program to help run the Rule Out HIV in the LAC, USC ED. And I wanted to just start, actually, by saying that I want you to note that what we call it, Rule Out HIV in the LAC, USC ED, and I'll come back to this many times, but are any of you clinicians at all? And so the rule out is a real common phraseology in clinical medicine, and that's intentional. And we'll talk a lot more about that, but I wanted to sort of foreshadow that. All right, so the objectives of this talk are relatively straightforward. We're going to describe our program. We're going to describe the rationale. We're going to describe the arguments that we made when we were trying to implement the program. We're going to review the results that we've had. And then we're going to focus a lot on the barriers to ED testing, particularly some of the more indistinct barriers as opposed to more of the technical barriers, because I think the technical ones are a little bit easier to cross off the list than the indistinct ones. So let me talk to you just briefly about myself. I'm not an HIV specialist. I'm an emergency physician. I practice in emergency departments and take care of gunshot wounds and stab wounds and things like that. I became interested in public health during my residency as it became evident that although I'm highly, highly trained in how to open up your chest if you get stabbed in it, that doesn't happen very often. And then when I do that, you always die anyway. So I started becoming more interested in chronic illness and how I could impact the health of my patients by linking them with continuity of care as they left the emergency department. And I initially focused a lot on diabetes because you go where the money is, and there's a lot of money for diabetes, and there's a lot of patients in the emergency department that have diabetes, it being the most common chronic disease in America. But as I got further along in this, the model became increasingly untenable. Diabetes isn't a really great model for chronic care because it doesn't respond the way we'd like to chronic care in general. And in fact, better chronic care isn't always associated with better outcomes in diabetes. So I started to look for different models, and HIV sort of came to me at that time. There were some people interested in doing this, and they were wondering if I might be interested as an emergency physician. And I thought, well, I'm tossing my diabetes model out, so maybe HIV is a good idea. Let's take a look. So with that, that was the genesis of our project, and it was the goals to rule out HIV at the USC. The major goals of the project are really, I mean, there's technical stuff like we want to test a lot of people, we want a case find, and I personally want to link them to chronic care and get their outcomes better. That's some of the technical stuff. But the more indistinct things are to change people's attitudes about HIV screening, particularly destigmatizing the process of testing for HIV, which is this, you know, and sorry for editorializing a lot, but that's just what I'm going to do. When you ask someone, a consent process for HIV, implicit in that, at least implicit from the patient's perspective, is that you think they have suffered from some moral failure, right? You wouldn't be asking me this if you didn't think I had sex, unprotected sex, or did drugs, or did something like that. And the patients know it, and you know that they know it, and that's the barrier, right there. That's it. That's the whole thing. Doctor's not going to do it. We don't like being uncomfortable. Patients don't like being uncomfortable. I don't like to make my patients more uncomfortable than is necessary. It's the whole thing. That's why targeted testing is silly, in my opinion, because you have to do all the uncomfortable stuff right up front. Like, oh, do you use drugs? Do you, all those things? Do you have sex with men? Those are questions we know doctors don't ask. They don't ask if it's relevant. You know, like you have an STI. It's like, okay, we'll just take your antibiotics. I don't want to talk to you about your partners. We know that. So a big part of our program was to try to destigmatize. I don't care who you are. I don't care. We test. It's that. It's not. There's no judgment on my part. I'm not judging you. Please don't feel that I'm judging you, etc. This is just what we do. And, that barrier is really important for us to get. And that has something to do with this end of HIV exceptionalism, that this test is something else. I mean, an HIV test for me is like a pregnancy test, only just very slightly more accurate. Okay, so, and that's just the way it has to be viewed. It can't be viewed in the context of, you know, is we're trying to, you know, find out, case find this and this and that. No, it's just a variable. It's a variable that we need to know in emergency medicine. So those are sort of the lead things that we're going for. I want us to think of HIV testing as a pregnancy test. It's a almost perfect test, very, very high specificity and sensitivity, excellent test. With pregnancy tests in emergency medicine, we usually use the rule of 8 and 80, so a woman between the ages of 8 and 80. Sometimes we do things like, hey, when was last period? And you know how much why we do that? Because people expect it. Do you think we listen to that? No. Right? Just, we don't care. It doesn't matter. You're between 8 and 80, and with obesity being what it is in America today, we might stretch that down to 6 and 80 because people, girls are starting to get pubescent a little earlier. So anyway, I think that I've beaten on that a little bit here. So some of the rest of the stuff is just technical. Like, we actually want to do the tests. In addition to changing these attitudes and stuff, we want to. That's how we're measuring our change in attitude, is by doing the tests. And then, really importantly, we want to link the positive patients. Again, this is really important to me, with outpatient care. And that goes for newly diagnosed folks, acutely infected folks, and also folks who were out of care previously. We use that as part of our umbrella, and I think that that was a sell for us going forward. So, why Los Angeles County? I mean, this is a slide shamelessly stolen from our local public health department. We have 60,000 people living with HIV in LA County, of which 12,000, almost 13,000 are thought to be unaware of their status, somewhere in the neighborhood of 21%. That is not good. As Monique already alluded to, or not alluded to, but specifically stated, they were responsible for a lot of transmission. So why? Oh, this is one of these heat maps, AIDSview heat map of Los Angeles. Those of you who aren't familiar with it, it looks like that's also a temperature heat map, more or less. In the center, it's hot. And this is where our hospital is, right in East LA. That's LACUSC Medical Center. There's another hot spot just to the north and west of us in West Hollywood. And so why our county hospital? Why LACUSC? Well, I mean, in a nutshell, size matters. LACUSC is a huge public safety net hospital. That's it. You may recognize it from the show General Hospital, where it was the, in the beginning. So that's the old hospital. The new one is this one. You can see the old one in the background. And it kind of looks more modern and cuboid. It is a massive institution on the top of the hill, and it's really a beacon for a lot of folks in our community. We see 1 million annual visits through the health to LACUSC in the outpatient and inpatient side every year, of which 170,000 come through the emergency department. It's a big emergency department. That includes adults, peds, psychiatric, etc. It's the largest ED in the Western U.S. and possibly in the whole of the United States. So, and for our patients, emergency department is often a sole source of care, not always, but often, and therefore it makes a certain amount of sense to go to LACUSCED when you're talking about targeted screening. So the other thing, so then in theory, it should be relatively straightforward, since anything that's ever been written about screening suggests that HIV would be a perfect thing to screen for. Right, it has all these characteristics. These are the Wilson criteria, WHO criteria, variably known, for things that make for an ideal test. And in fact, if we go down this list, you'll see that things start to break down for diabetes. That's why I started to get disinterested with it. It just doesn't work very well because it's not exactly clear in diabetes who should be treated, etc. In HIV, you'll find that all of these things apply really, really well. We understand the disease course really well. We understand that if you treat it early, it impacts the long-term. There's a big latent phase. All these things over and over and over, we now have a pretty good consensus on who should be treated once they're diagnosed with HIV. In addition, it's communicable, so you know that's not on this list, but basically this should be perfect. So when you try to go to an emergency department and ask them to do screening, of course they want to do it, right? No, of course. As Dr. Glick has already said, they don't. The emergency department will reject this almost, they will right away reject it. And what will the arguments be? We're too busy. This is someone else's problem. This is a gay problem. This is a social problem. This is a public health problem. This isn't an ED problem. Can't they get screened elsewhere? We've already mentioned that frequently these patients are the ED is their sole source of care. There are some missed opportunities. When we did a deep dive at our positives, we found that only a third of them had a prior visit within the past year and a half that we were able to look in through their records. So we find that they actually don't have a lot of other opportunities to be screened. What do you say to a new positive, right? I don't know, I'm scared. I mean, that is like, honestly, I can do this because I'm an ED doc. I can say that is the worst excuse I've ever heard in my life. I mean, we tell people all the time, you have cancer, you know, you have all of these other diseases that are much, 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 much more deadly, and you're going to sit here and tell me, like, I'm scared to tell somebody they have HIV. I mean, come on, you're an ER doc, you cut people's chests open for a living, you're scared of telling this absurd concept. It's laughable, it really is laughable. Don't let them get away with that. That's not true. They don't want to do it. It's just it's that simple. It's not that they're scared or they don't know how or anything. You know, it's absurd. What are the resources available? Again, cancer. You get people with lumps and bumps. And I mean, we tell people you have a little spot on your chest, on the chest x-ray. We tell them that could be cancer, right? There's a 99% chance that it's not. But we have no problem saying, hey, you might have cancer, right? But no, suddenly with HIV, we're terrified. And we don't worry about their resources. We say, go get an x-ray in a few months or go talk to your doctor about the spot that might be cancer in your lungs. But suddenly when it's HIV, it's like we need to have all these ducks in a row and we need to have all these scripts. It's just, it's exceptionalism. It's not thinking about HIV in a proper medical context. And I'll get back into that. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of objections that people say. Broadly, I think they boil down to four categories. You'll see only three here, because the fourth one I think is actually the most important. There's legal concerns around consenting and documentation and CLIA and all this kind of stuff. There's financial stuff, who's going to pay for it? It's so expensive, blah, blah, blah. I don't respect that argument very much either, to be honest. And then there's technical stuff. Who's going to run the test? How long is it going to take? What's the turnaround time, et cetera? You can read all of those if you choose to. But I think the real big obstacle is one of mindset. And I apologize for the goofy graphic. I'm not a very new agey person in general, but I do believe that mindset is the biggest obstacle. And so I did want to play this video. This is from a movie called Code Black. It's in theaters near you now, and it's a documentary made about our emergency department. And I just want to show the mindset. This is a real movie. This isn't fake. It's not funny. Don't anticipate laughing.
Someone is suffering. What are you going to do?
You can have these moments that are big, that are larger than life.
You're in a crisis situation.
I think those are pretty high stakes. It's a team fighting to save someone's life.
It's pretty powerful imagery, even though it's not a very good movie. So that's the mindset of emergency medicine. That's where we live. It's moments that are bigger than life. I mean, these are the words that, you know, that's one of our residents right now, that they believe that. But it's silly. It's not about moments that are bigger than life. It is actually our life. It is actually what we do, and it doesn't look like that most of the time. It does sometimes for, you know, probably on every shift we get moments that look just like that. But most of the time, it doesn't look anything like that. So, you know, when we've got this mindset, it doesn't reflect our ED reality, and then we come in and someone says, hey, let's do HIV screening. It's public health screening or something like that, right? And then that's HIV is a public health problem, and I reject that. HIV is not a public health problem, okay? It's not. It's not. I know that's weird to say at an APHA meeting. I will defend my position momentarily. This is public health in the ED. This is all the interventions that have been done in the ED. Blah, look at HIV. Did I highlight him? Maybe I have a little. Yeah, I think I did. Look, he's like fighting for space between heart disease and immunizations. 10 below arthritis and osteoporosis screen. These are all interventions that are published and described. This is not happening in the emergency department, right? We don't do these. In fact, Kellen really summarized this pretty well, that, yeah, okay, it takes a couple of minutes per patient, but a couple of minutes times 170,000 is a lot of hours lost where it's not like EDs are sitting around sitting on their hands all day. We've got lots of stuff to do. So there are very few EDs that are willing to take on public health burdens. And I agree with that, actually. I agree with that. It's a tough challenge to make something, to take a pure public health intervention into the emergency department. But I don't think it is a public health problem. I think it's a medical problem. And I suggest that when you're thinking about this, that you try to reframe HIV testing in that context. And I have just two simple cases here. These are real cases, but it doesn't matter. One's a 30-year-old homeless guy who was disheveled, a little bit confused, had a rash, headache, and nausea. His temperature was 99.8, and that was it. So every emergency department person, physician, every clinical practitioner would be saying, oh gosh, this is an IDU with all these issues, this is probably HIV related or something like that. Guy needs a tap, he needs to get a spinal tap and a bunch of other things, etc. And this is a 54-year-old woman with shortness of breath. And the paradox here is that they're the opposite, right? He doesn't have HIV. Now, if you're an emergency physician, that test just saved your night. Okay, because now he doesn't need an LP. He's not particularly febrile. He's not particularly ill-appearing. I doubt he has acute bacterial meningitis, and he's HIV negative. And this woman, the 54-year-old with shortness of breath, who you thought was going to be some kind of CHF or pneumonia or bronchitis or something like that, suddenly could be something completely different, right? Suddenly could be PCP pneumonia or otherwise. So what I suggest then is that when you're framing this out to folks is that you think of HIV as an individual clinical problem. HIV status is a clinically relevant data point in the emergency department. Right? So whether it's positive, like pregnancy, positive or negative, it just changes your differential diagnosis a little bit. And that the public health and the community health effects are just, those are second, they're just added as cherry on top. But the rest of it is actually clinically relevant stuff, and I avoid using public health as much as I possibly can because that conjures the list of all the other public health things that we're not doing in the emergency department, and we're very well socialized to not do public health in the emergency department. You see that list that we're not doing. All right, so how to implement this. Now I'll go quicker. It's a lot of the same stuff that Dr. Glick alluded to, and every institution is going to be a little bit different, but you need strong team. You need ED personnel. You need lab personnel. You need outpatient resources. Those are your clinic partners that you're going to be referring these folks to. And then in our case, you need information services or IT. Legal risk management, hospital administration. I put those in parentheses because they can be as much harm as help. And I sort of, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along, because I'm a big ask for forgiveness, not permission kind of person. It's just the way I run my life. It's a little dangerous, but usually I get through it okay. And that's what we did here. So, keys, listen very carefully to the stakeholders, right? When they're giving you all those objections, listen. There's all sorts of listen. We have grand rounds where all the faculty and residents get together, but others have varying different kinds of conferences. We go to the nursing meetings. We listen to patients and their families. We talk to them about this. What does this mean to them? Now, patients don't, you know, care so much, but that's, I mean, they were really ready to accept this. I acknowledge, and this is in implementation, acknowledge that imperfections are going to be in the program. The idea that you're going to have a perfect program when you start is completely crazy. There's no way. There's a million things that are going to go wrong. So accept that part of what you do when you implement this is you're going to be flexible. And that's the strong team that you have. That's one of its core characteristics, in my opinion, that you have to have. And feedback over and over. Every time there's a positive that someone didn't expect, that's the one. That's the case that the doc goes, oh, I am so glad I knew that. Or a negative that they didn't know. You know, feed it back to them. Tell them that that person got care. Now all of a sudden this is seeming more and more clinically relevant. All right, so our program now, just talk quickly about our program. We've had three different models. We had a dedicated staff model where we hired individuals to do the testing. That then turned into this lab-based model, which initially involved the dedicated testers ordering the tests, and then it was drawn by the nurses, et cetera, and then finally a more integrated model that we're at now, and that's where we are now. An HIV specialist, in our case, it's an HIV fellow, a person doing an extra year of training after their family medicine training, responds in real time to new diagnoses, and that's a huge benefit and a huge plus that we have, and I know isn't realistic for everyone, but that has persisted across all three models. This is a dedicated tester model, no worries. This is not a HIPAA. That is, in fact, one our dedicated tester, Adriana, but that is not a patient. That is my secretary. So This is the dedicated tester model. This is our first sort of 18 months. We tested 10,000 people. I wanted to highlight this. You know, we had 40 new cases, and this was back in 2011. Very few people opted out, actually. We had 89% non-opt-out. California has good opt-out laws, and we're very aggressive with what constitutes a consent. We say we're going to do an HIV test, and they basically have to come and like try to tackle us away from them. This is why you don't get risk management involved early, because they don't like that kind of stuff. But you know, my interpretation of the law was that it was okay. So we have a really aggressive policy towards it. And if I have time at the end, I'll tell you a really interesting story about a problem we're having with consent with an individual. Like a patient. The dedicated tester, what are the lessons learned there? They were really helpful in maintaining high quality standards, which was important, I think, when we first started this. This is new. You're asking people to come into your emergency department and do all these things, and you want your books to look good. And our when you turn it over to physicians to order and do all these kinds of things, it gets a little messier. So at least in the beginning stages, we felt very comfortable that we were delivering what we said we were going to deliver. And so I thought the dedicated model was very helpful for that. They were a great resource for clinicians as they're learning how to give this, you know, life-changing news, you know, that someone has HIV, and they just hear it. They hear the testers or the educators or the HIV fellow do it, and the tester in our case would even call the HIV fellow to then do it, to then come meet with the patient. And that process just made everything really easy. It's not any different, you know, to tell someone that they have HIV or that their test is positive. It's no different than some other bad. I mean, we tell people that their family members were killed in a knife and gunfight. I mean, you know, this happens a lot. This idea that you couldn't do this is obviously false, and just having the testers around in the beginning of the program to sort of normalize that or at least contextualize it within other things that we do was very helpful. Some of the problems with dedicated testers are that they're very costly, and then reliability is an issue in that, you know, they're people and they go on maternity leave and they quit and go get a better job and all that kind of stuff, and then your program comes to a grinding halt. So we weren't a huge fan of that model. Once we implemented the architect, we saw, that's the blood-based screening, we saw a huge increase in tests from 9,000 in the sort of 15 months before to 22,000 in the 15 months after. We saw a very big jump in the number of new diagnoses from 36 in the, I know I said 40, but that was 18 months. So this is 36 in the 15 months before to 115 in the last 15 months. And, of course, now we have the ability through the architect to detect acute infections, and we've seen 14 in the last 15 months. So I don't know why I have that, just because I always have silly things in my slides. So if you can see that, what you actually see on our testing timeline is a few key moments. We had a second tester for a while, and you can see what that did. It, you know, 1.5 increased our testing, not very dramatic. Nothing much happened, and even when we did the architect, but it was the tester or the HIV person and not the clinician ordering it, it didn't really do very much. We then added some competition in, like you did, with a lot of feedback saying who's the best and the greatest, and we gave them some nominal prizes like, you know, coffee mugs, and that actually caused a slight surge in testing. Right? You saw our level go up, double up. But what happened most recently is we put in an EHR-based pop-up reminder. It's really straightforward in our case. It doesn't order the test automatically. It just says, CDC recommends these for these kinds of patients. Would you like to order the test? And you can click yes. And then you see what happened is our testing increased fourfold. So the effect of the EHR modification, it's only been 4 months, I guess five now, since we've been doing it. Tests have more than doubled. The number of new diagnoses increased, not quite as strongly as the number of tests, but we're up to, you know, 3,000+ tests a month now, and the number of known positive increased a lot. Acute infections increased a bit as well. So our link to care rates, I'll just spend 1 second talking about that. We've done pretty well for acute infections. They've all been linked to care. For our new diagnoses, very good linkage rates at 84%. We'd like it to be a little higher, but nonetheless. But also our known HIV positive out of care, the ones that, you know, we're just sort of caught in our program. We're not even testing them. We try not to test them. So when possible, sometimes they get caught, we verify. We're able to relink 50% of those patients back with a primary an HIV specialist, and that's defined, like I say here, as a confirmed outpatient visit to an HIV provider. So the key lessons learned are, you know, it takes a village. You do need a whole team of people with broad representation to make this happen. But I think point two is probably the biggest point from my perspective. The providers need to see the value of both a positive and a negative test. The way it shrinks and changes their differential diagnoses, that changes the way they behave. And then they just start using it. Then it's reflexive, just like a pregnancy test. We're not risk stratifying, when was your last period, who do you have sex with, whatever. With a pregnancy test and HIV is the same thing. It's just one more thing at the end of a Chem 7, that gives me a little bit more information. I'll tell you right now, it gives them a lot more information than a BUN does, which is a common thing that's at the end of a Chem 7, which is very little value ever. So, and then the other things are about feedback loops. And then in our case, an EHR pop-up was a huge boon to this program. And finally, my ask forgiveness, not permission. I have acknowledged these are some of the many people that work on this, including the head of DHS, Department of Health Services in LA County, Mitch Katz, who's been very helpful of late. That's it for my talk. I'll take any questions you have or wait until after Grant's done. Up to you guys.